Hi everybody. My name's Greg. I'll be doing the talk today. I'll be talking about is a guide that I had written at Tomio's request. I entitled it, what did I call it? Cloud Formations, a guide to, I don't know, doing Zen forms both at home and in the cloud Zendo. Despite the title, I think a lot of the information in this book is useful both to the people in the cloud and for those of you in the dirt Zendo. So thank you all for showing up today. I was kind of sure after seeing the title of this in the newsletter that none of you were going to be there, especially a day after Zazen Kai. So I'm really happy to see you all. I hope there's a lot of information for you in here too. I think there will be. And not to mention the fact that like we don't know when the next global pandemic's going to be or whatever other craziness could happen. And could be another point where those of you on the dirt need to zoom in, like those of us in the cloud. And there's, if you forget from the pandemic what some of the different issues you may have as a Cloud Zendo member are, then this hopefully lays those out for you and is a good quick review for you. When Domio asked me to do this, write the booklet, she basically just asked me for. She didn't give me much direction. She just said that you should write a document that explains how to do the Zen forms from the cloud, how to adapt them to cloud practice. And at first I was like, cool, like 2 or 3 pages, that should be nothing, no big deal. And the more I thought about it, the more it sounded like this book that I always wished had existed and had never been able to find. And the title of that book might be something like How to Do Zen. Like I found lots of resources on how to do Zazen. I found lots of there's thousands of books on the Dharma that help us to understand why we do Zen. But I before I started practicing with all of you, there was a local group here in Reno where I live that I would meet with, and I'd go there and I'd be like, how do all these people know how to do this stuff? Like they're moving in unison, they're chanting together, they're bowing, they know when to bow, they know when to put their hands like this, they know when to put their hands like this. Like, where does all this come from? Like, I picked a lot of it up through osmosis. I found random books. There's this book, Taking the Path of Zen by Robert Aiken, that kind of touches on some of this stuff, but it's not very thorough. There's a lot of other stuff in there. There's this other book. It looks like a kid's book. It looks like a coloring book inside. It's not, you see, there's like much bigger pictures than there are words, but which is good for a book on the Zen forms because these are all like visual things that we do in person. They're the way we dress, the way we move. So it's good to have pictures, but like this actually has a lot of really good information in it. It's called The Complete Illustrated Guide to Zen by Saigaku Omoto. And it's just really helpful. It gives you a lot of background on why we do some of the forms and shows you how to do them. But again, it just really wasn't giving me what I needed to understand just how to get through a Sunday or a Tuesday evening with all of you. Like there was a lot of stuff I still didn't get. So this book that I wound up writing it wound up being like 60 something pages, and hopefully it kind of answers all the questions that you all may have, both sitting there in Beaverton and sitting in your individual homes and in front of a computer, just to know like when am I supposed to have my hands in gassho? Like at what point during the chanting service can I have my hands in my lap, and when should I be holding them in gassho? When I'm doing kinhin, should my left hand or my right hand be on top of my fist? Just ran all that random stuff that seems like everybody knows but you. I don't know if you feel that way, but I've always felt like everybody gets it but me. So this book is for all of you who feel like everybody gets it but you. We don't have much time to go through 60 something pages, and this is a book that's freely available to all of you on the website under the resources tab. Currently, because it's new, there's like a special tab for it right on the homepage. I doubt it'll be there forever, but I think it'll always be up on that resources tab. You can just scroll down there and look at it anytime you want in much greater detail than we'll have time to do here today. What I want to do, if it's all right with all of you, is just read off some stuff I wrote this morning to kind of give some context for the creation of the book and what the book is meant to do. Then I'll kind of just read the introduction of it word for word to you. And then I'll kind of go through it chapter by chapter and just kind of like hit some of the highlights and kind of show you like this is what this chapter has, especially for those of you in the dirt sender. Like some of the stuff isn't going to be relevant to you. I just want to show you like what pieces of information are where in the book, what you can skip. It's a lot of reading to do. Some of you may want to read it all, but some of you may want to jump around and just pick up key parts. So my goal is just to identify all those key parts so everybody knows like what to skip to if they don't want to read it cover to cover. My biggest goal is to leave time for questions at the end. There's a lot of pictures in this guide that show how to practice these forms. But video may be a better platform to demonstrate some of them. So if there are forms that come up as we go through this that you were always like, I wish somebody would just stand in front of me and show me how to do this form, this is your chance to do that. So it's going to be annoying, but I set an alarm on my phone that's going to go off at noon. Wherever I am, I'm just going to rush through the rest of the book just so we can get to questions. So if there are questions like those, please bring those questions about like, I don't know how to do a full prostration. I see everybody doing it slightly differently. Show us how to do that. And I can do that on screen, or maybe somebody in the Dirt Sendo can do it in person for everybody there. And we'll make sure everybody just knows how to do anything that they have questions about. So I'm just going to read some stuff to you. And here I go. So what do we mean by the Zen forms? The Zen forms are basically the customs and rituals of our practice. The form of an object is what tells you what it is. It's the appearance, the structure, the shape of a thing. The Zen forms are what give our practice shape. It's what it looks like. This is how you do Zen. You can look at a group of people practicing Judaism and another practicing Zen and easily identify which group is which by the forms that they're engaged in, by the clothes they wear, the way the rooms that they're in are decorated, the way they sing, pray, chant, the languages they use to sing, pray, or chant, the way they greet one another, the way they move, the way they show gratitude to one another, the way they help each other. These are all very specific to each of these different spiritual paths, including our own. So if Dharma is what we believe, the forms are what we do. It's the shape and appearance that we give to our practice. So the purpose of the forms. The forms can serve as a strong metaphor for interconnectedness or interbeing. We're like a chorus where multiple singers harmonize, bringing multiple different parts together to create a unified whole where the sum is greater than its parts. So we're all bowing together, we're all chanting together, we're all bringing ourselves to each and every one of those activities, but we're all bringing something unique to them and we're sharing with each other. Like I said, a lot of this we're learning through osmosis. Just by watching people on the screen or in the room that we're in. I don't know about you, but I have a certain person whose box I look at when I can't remember if my hand should be in Gassho or in Shashu. I have a certain person whose box I'll look at if I can't remember if I'm supposed to be bowing now or not. Various things like that. I think we all have people that we identify as like good at this stuff, and we look at them. So it's another way that we're interconnected. We're helping each other just by doing our practice without even trying. So the forms then are what bind us together as that group. Half of us are in the Dirt Sendo, the other half are spread out across the world. The forms are what make us one Sangha, a unified entity. They're our chance to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. They also bring us into the moment. So I have a note here that just says riff on bowing. What I'm getting at with that is my wife is kind of a on again, off again sort of a Buddhist. She's interested in it and she does some of this stuff with me, but she's obviously not here. You don't know her, you've never met her. She did all the illustrations in the book that I'm about to show you though. I do all the sessions that I've done so far, maybe 6 to 8. I've done at Shasta Abbey. And she's gone to maybe half of those with me. And she's not into the whole bowing thing. And I'm going to talk more about bowing later. But she's like, do I have to bow to like all these statues? Like there's a walkway at Shasta Abbey, which is nearby here. It's a couple hours close to Reno. So I just do all the session that I do there. But you have to walk on this pathway between the Zendo where we meditate and really, the only other place you can go at the Abbey is the dorm rooms or the dining rooms. So there's this pathway that connects those three things, and the rest is kind of like the monks area. But there's maybe like 10 statues on that walkway, and you bow to every single one of them. You stop walking and you bow to them. And my wife's like, do I have to bow to all these things really? And I'm like, well, like, if you want to be a Buddhist, you do, but you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. Like, nobody's here to like judge you or to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. But yeah, it's like respectful to bow to these statues. So she doesn't do it. So when we're walking down that walkway together, I'm always kind of like, just like, all right, yeah, like I'll put up one hand and like casually, like kind of like bow to it and try to be cool in front of my wife, and just kind of like go through the motions. But when she's not there, like I do the full bows and it's an entirely different experience. Like I don't do a full prostration, but like I'll put both my hands in gassho, I'll stop walking, I'll bow to it, and like I'm like immediately in the present moment. Like there's benefits to like performing these forms. Like it's a sign of respect to bow to those statues, but there's also stuff that we're getting out of it too. It snaps us into the moment. I can hear the birds singing when I actually put myself into those bows and do them wholeheartedly. I can hear the rain falling. It's always raining or snowing in Mount Shasta, it seems like. So you hear the rain falling, you hear snowdrops catching onto the piled up snow. It's just this really beautiful moment where you're stopped and forced to be part of the moment and then continue walking to wherever you're headed. So that's my riff on bowing, but I have another one coming up. So to continue, when we engage with the forms wholeheartedly, they allow us to be one with the moment and with the Sangha. Every form described in this book and in this talk can help us to erase the distinctions between the self and the other, sentient and non-sentient, past and future, here and now, and to view these elements as one unified entity, reality itself. If you just want to read the Dharma and sit zazen, that's totally cool. No one's going to force you to do anything else. No one's going to expect anything else from you. No one's going to judge you for it. But zazen and the Dharma came about within the context of ritual, of chanting, of bowing, of making offerings, of making and wearing vestments, of accepting charity, of following a moral code. Zazen, I'm sure, is still beneficial without the context of these forms and our moral code, but it runs the risk of becoming little more than a pop mindfulness fad we learned about on Instagram if we don't also follow along by practicing the forms wholeheartedly. So here's where I wanted to ask you all a question. What problems do you think practicing the forms could cause with your practice or just in your lives in general? Like the idea of these forms, as I'll get to, is to bring these forms out into the world with us. And like I gave you the example of like being kind of embarrassed around my wife to bow sometimes. It happens here in the house all the time too. I have my altar right there. Every time I'm in this hallway here, if I can see that altar, I bow to it. But if my wife's around, like I look to see if my wife's there before I bow, so I don't look weird. Like I asked Domio about this, I guess years ago now, when I first started practicing with you all. Like, how do I do this stuff around my family? Like, I don't even know if I'm in a cult right now. Like, I don't know what this is. I'm all doing all this weird stuff. It seems to be working for me, but some of it looks weird. And like her answer boiled down basically to like, just don't be weird. Like do it in ways that aren't weird. And that's, I think, the best piece of advice she's given to me that I applied to everything in this practice. And there are ways to incorporate these forms into every aspect of our life without looking weird. And so part of my aim with the book is to kind of show you how to do that and not be weird. But I'm weird by nature, so I may not have been that effective with it. But do you all see any challenges with engaging and bowing around your house or chanting and during Sunday practice with your family in the next room over out loud or anything like that?
Greg, this is so great. Thank you. Yeah, it's funny because I started to be host for Saturday mornings and be the host that at home. And I always think, oh, I have to find like a place where no one can hear me or see me because this is really weird, and they're going to hear me doing the Bodhisattva vows chants, and or any time I'm at home and doing a chant something, I have to. I'm always worried, oh, they're going to hear me. Like, that's going to be really weird. And so I'm struggling with that too. And it's really funny because what are they? I mean, who, it's I, I'm th I'm trying to think like they have no idea what goes on when I'm at the Zendo. So maybe this is a good way of just letting them know. I don't know. I have no idea what they think goes on over there when I say we have chanting service. So, yeah, I'm here with you. I feel the same way.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, the same thing happens here. Like, not all of us are as lucky as I am, I think, to have a partner who will just go to Shasta Abbey with you for a week out of the blue and see people do this. So, but ever since she started doing those things, like, I can just bow to my altar and she's like, oh, okay, I get what he's doing now. So it's nice to have a family who are open to kind of trying to understand these things that we do and see the importance of them. And we've taken a bodhisattva vow, and it's our goal to kind of like share this with people and show people how pleasurable this can be. Like, we may not want to, we're not like evangelists, and we're not trying to suck people into this necessarily, but these little things can rub off on people and it makes them a little bit more bodhisattva-like themselves. I have friends who know I'm Buddhist and they gassho to me when they see me. Like, I didn't ask them to do that, I didn't teach them to do that. I don't know where they've even seen that, but it's just such a sweet thing that they do. And it's so nice to just find out your friends are willing to like do that for you. And if they can do that for me, then why can't I do these things in front of them? I think Dave was before Rachel.
Yeah, I mean, you brought that up. I used to feel weird about bowing all the time, but I kind of got over it. I mean, when I started, most of my first initial Zoom experiences were practicing here. And so now it feels weird to end a Zoom call and not bow. So I bow in work calls. I bow like all the time. And if people get weirded out by it, that's really not my concern anymore. And even do it in person. But I found that like COVID is a good excuse. Like you bow at people and they're in lieu of shaking hands, they're like, I'm like, yeah, COVID, whatever.
That's cool. Rachel.
So my meditation center is my bedroom. It's a very small table, very and I always have to break it down and bring it back up, break it down, bring it back up. So when the form says bow, leave your slippers or things outside your the Zendo and stuff, that gets kind of rough because you'll see my because I'm bowing into my bedroom and people are staring like, what is she doing? What is this? And I always feel so awkward doing it. Because, this is also a place for me to sleep and stuff. And I'm kind of wondering if everyone else is in kind of the same spot of you're sharing a space with more than just a meditation place. It's also like a bedroom or an office or something.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the unique challenges of the cloud. We're trying to squeeze this stuff into the place that we live in. But I hope that after this talk, if you haven't done it already, a lot of you in the Dirt Zendo too, if you haven't already, are building these places into your homes too, where you have an altar or somewhere that you can practice at home. Like, I know most of us probably sit Zazen more than just Sunday mornings or Tuesday nights. So there's got to be a place in other people's bedrooms too, Rachel, where they're doing these things at least to some extent too. We'll take Denny, and then time's moving fast, so we got to move on.
I had a hard time listening to Dave or hearing Dave, but I think he was saying that he finds himself bowing in public, and I do the same thing. And I used to just feel like I had to apologize, but now I just do it, and it feels comfortable. And usually people smile at me. But the other thing I wanted to say is that I have a hard time with the altar thing. And I have one now. I've never been inclined to do it, but I decided I would try it. And that is something that I feel like I have to protect anytime somebody comes into my studio, protect in that I imagine that they just find it really strange and I still find it a little strange. And so I was just curious. And if we don't have time to talk about this, maybe I can just pick it up another time. But I was just wondering if other people felt that way.
Yeah, then it comes up in the book and hopefully in the talk. I have the same thing. My altar's in this room that I'm sitting in now, but my nephew and my brother-in-law were in here the other day, and my nephew was like playing with all the stuff on the altar. And his uncle and my brother-in-law, his father, was there with me, and I'm like explaining what my nephew's asking. He's 3, almost 4 years old, and he's asking like what all this stuff is and what I do with it. And I'm like, is this okay that I tell him this? Like, I don't know, like, if it's appropriate or not. Like, they're kind of like right wing Christian, even like evangelist people. And his dad was like, no, go for it. Like, he wants to know, like, tell him what it is. So it's important, I think, to share this stuff with our families and the people we love and our friends. And I think the more I do that, the more I realize that like none of them are judging me.
Yeah. Have you ever had any problem though with having an altar? I'm trying to get through that, and
Like
maybe
it
I should state
fluctuated,
that.
or what kind of a problem do you mean?
I guess for me, like the connection with Buddha and the Dharma and just being, I've taken Jukai and I have a very regular meditation practice every single day, and it's just something that's a big part of me now. It's something that's sacred to me, and I just can't get used to the idea of having objects that I bow to, because it's not the objects, it's not any of and the form I can understand, the wagesa I can understand, but I just have a problem
Yeah,
with
I get where you're
an
coming
altar.
from. Yeah, I have that too. For me, it's more for bowing to the central image on the altar, the Buddha. For me, I see, especially when I first started out, like I didn't bow at all. Especially the full prostrations, I would not do them. And this is included in my altar because my Buddha statue is part of my, or it's a picture, but it's part of my altar. And I felt really like I grew up in the Catholic Church. I was really resented. All of the pomp and circumstance and the forms that came along with that, genuflecting to a person on the cross. And so then when it came to Zen, I was like, this is a guy who I don't believe like really knew suffering. Like, he was a prince, but I'm talking about the Buddha. He was a prince. He left his family after he saw a sick person and a person that died, and an old person just walking on the streets. Like, why should I bow to him? Like, he's like a deadbeat dad, right? This isn't ex these aren't my beliefs now, but like initially that was really difficult for me to bow to a patriarch who left his family. And that's probably deals a lot with my own like personal family issues, but yeah, it's hard for me to bow to an altar. It's hard for me to bow to an image of the Buddha, but I came to see that Buddha not as a man, but as a metaphor for the Buddha nature that runs through all of us and everything, what's good in the world. And this thing that I'm using this practice to uncover, I'm peeling, every time I sit Zazen in front of that same altar, I'm peeling away another, I'm trying, hopefully trying to pull away another layer of the causes and the conditions and the karma that have piled themselves on top of that Buddha nature that are pushing me down. So when I kneel in front of that altar, that's the weight of all of those causes and conditions pushing me down on my knees. But that's only half the bow. Like, I stand back up again. And so I do that 6 times a day. We all did it 6 times this morning. We let the weight of reality push us to our knees. If we're physically able to get down on our knees, some of us do a modified version, but we let the weight of the world push us down in front of our Buddha nature, and all we do is just get back up and do it again. And if I do that 6 times in the morning, when I get to work and I go to some pointless meeting and all these people are yammering on and their egos are just like bouncing back and forth off of each other, I don't get fired from that job because I don't lash out and tell them like, this is a pointless meeting and you're all pointless, like I want to do, because that's just a layer of causes and conditions that are burying the Buddha nature that wants me to give compassion to them because they haven't found theirs yet. So when I'm bowing to this altar, I'm bowing I'm not bowing. I'm getting back up again when life knocks me down. So for me, that's how I make sense of bowing to the altar. I make offerings to my altar too, which isn't hard for me either because I also have the blood vein on my altar, our lineage, and in an envelope that I got from Shasta Abbey when I took Chukai there. And inside that, I have all these relics from different family members of mine that have died. And when I put decaf coffee on my altar every morning, that's for my dad. It's for my grandmother. It's for my other grandmother whose lap I used to sit on while she stirred milk into her coffee. And when I bow, I'm just saying hello to the people I can't say to in person anymore. So it's not hard for me to bow, but it was.
Thank you so much.
Jimmy?
Thank
Well,
you, Greg.
sorry.
Ruth Ann, go ahead.
Thank you for your scholarship and your reverence and effort in putting this together. One of my teachers and author, Stephen Jenkinson, grief counselor from Toronto, said North Americans are ritual deprived. And actually, I know as a hospice volunteer, we're a culture that is death denial too. So sometimes in doing for me, the bowing, the ritual, I'm just acknowledging that this is my kind of instrument that I'm able to use in whatever way I'm choosing. And I'm in connection with eons of people that have followed the beloved one through these times of being human. So I just see that connection, and it's kind of, I don't have to, explain it, but I know when I had a time for a few months, I was getting visiting nurses come in for a few hours. For sure, there'd be one or two who did a quick double take on my mini altar in the living room, and I think that's okay, but our American culture, we look for ritual. I mean, the term man cave, that's been around for at least a decade. And if we have pets, for sure they have their ritual. I mean, they don't have to explain themselves in our homes. So again, thank you for this.
Thank you.
And thank you also, Greg, for this wonderful online booklet. And please thank your wife for the illustrations. They're wonderful.
Thank you, I will.
I was just going to add very quickly, I was thinking this morning because, as many of you know, I've been out because I had knee surgery, and I think this morning was my first service, since mid-November. And the words went through my head, I love this ritual. And what I do remember when I first came to Brightway Zen for the very first time, and I bowed to the Buddha, I thought to myself, I am bowing to something that is greater than me. And that's the reminder that I need. This is it's a thought, it's a concept, whatever you want to call it. But I am, at least at this point during my day, bowing to something that is bigger than myself, and that's important for me to remember. I have a couple of altars here and there around my house, and as many of you know, we moved into this smaller home in August. It's the same little altars, it's the same Buddha, big heavy Buddha on my deck that I had at my old house. But for some reason, I bow to that Buddha every morning now and set my intention. So something was going on in my practice that caused me to start doing that here. when for all the years that I've had that statue, I did not do it. So what I wanted to add to the conversation was our practice is constantly changing, and as we go through it over time, things that used to feel different or feel weird don't feel so weird anymore. And I will close with this one thing about something weird. I had my right knee replaced, and I found out a few weeks back that my surgeon, my own orthopedic surgeon, is going to have something done to his knee. And I knew that when I saw him this week, it would be the last, I was his last patient before he had to have surgery. And as our conversation came to an end, I said, "May you be in the best possible health and may you have limited pain." And he backed away from me really quick. And all I'm saying is, if you're going to do things like that, it was so natural for me because, as you know from a couple of weeks ago, I ho love the whole loving kindness thing. But we do have to expect that people are going to have strange reactions to it, and it's okay.
Oh, it's okay. Right. 3 minutes till my alarm's going to go off to ask questions. So, and we haven't even opened the book yet. So, I'm going to do my best to get through this as fast as possible. Let me share it with you all so you can see it. Can you see that? Yeah. All right. Wish I could. Let's see. All right. It's scrolling right now, right? You guys can see it moving. Okay. So I couldn't remember the title because it's super long, just like the book. So here it is: Cloud Formations, A Guide to Making the Most of Zen Forms at Home and in the Cloud Tempo. Here's my wife's beautiful picture. I asked her to paint a picture that showed clouds somehow becoming part of the dirt. And she's like, "Do you mean rain?" And I said, "Yes, that's why I consider you a genius and me an idiot. Rain is what connects clouds to the dirt. So we have the clouds here, some Dharma rain connecting with these mountains to create some mud for all of us lotus flowers to grow out of. There's our fearless leader. This quote I found, the teacher's job is to practice. And a student's job is to practice with their teacher. I don't know why, I just find that really powerful. Some acknowledgments. A lot of people helped me with this. Jinryu and James both saw early drafts of this and gave me a lot of advice. James gave me this great tip that I should make links within the text so it's easy to navigate within the text. I did that, but all of my other tech problems made it impossible to transfer those. You wouldn't believe how large this file is, and it's impossible to upload it to anywhere and share it with people without compressing it. First converting it to a PDF, then compressing the PDF. So I lost the internal links. I don't know how to get them back. I tried everything. I spent hours on it. But all the links to outside sources that I wanted in the book are still there. So thanks for the tip, James. I'm sorry. It didn't work. I thought it was a great one, and I did try to use it, but I'm just not good enough at computers. We'll get to as many questions as we can. But we need to go through the book that this talk is supposed to be about. I'm going to skip the introduction. You can all read this. It was in the newsletter on Friday. It's online. It's in the book, and it's on the homepage for the book. But we basically talked about everything that this said anyway at this point between my little introduction, all the questions. This is my great haiku. I do write a lot of haikus, and this is my best one. I was sure this was going to get cut by Domio, but she really didn't change much with the content. She helped me with the organization a lot. She corrected mistakes I made on how and when to use certain forms. She found a lot of typos that I thought weren't there. But this is probably my best haiku. It says, "Oh, Kardashians, how long till the next season? Must keep up with you." So the point here, I'm talking here about like how the forms can be a way of defining our lives. Forms, our very self, in a way, is a collection of forms that we've developed, and usually like unhelpful, inefficient, and inappropriate ways. Sometimes they're burdens that are put upon us by capitalists, CEOs, advertising executives, politicians that shape the way that we behave. And this part, I'm just kind of talking about like, if your life were a haiku, like what forms would you like to apply to it? Do you want to use the Zen forms that help give it like the beautiful shape, like is Kobayashi Issa's haiku here, a world of dew, and within every dewdrop, a world of struggle? Like the person that wrote that is free. They're liberated, they're enlightened. But this idiot here that's talking to you now that wrote this Kardashians haiku, he's not enlightened. He's bound by what Instagram and the TV and his politicians want him to do and think and behave. So our practice, these forms are a way to give a better shape to our lives, to make our lives shape more like the haiku of someone who's enlightened, who's liberated, than someone who just sits around watching TV all day. I found this quote. It's from Branford Marsalis, the saxophonist. It's like, wrote it down somewhere. It's there's only freedom in structure. There's no freedom in freedom. Freedom can only exist within form, within structure, within incarceration. They have to exist in opposition to one another. You can't have freedom without also having incarceration, or what are you free from? So these forms give a shape to our practice, but we're also a crowd who's not really into attachments. We're really into emptiness. And so it's important to keep in mind, and that's kind of what I'm getting at in this part of the introduction that we didn't really talk about up to this point. You can be loose with these things. Like, it's great that we're all able to work as a unified whole by chanting together, and bowing together. But if you need to modify these forms, modify these forms. If these forms interfere with your mental or physical health, modify these forms. These aren't cut in stone. If you want to be truly free, you'll do so by shaping these forms to fit the life that you live. And that's why there probably aren't many books out there that say how to do Zen, because a lot of it's up to you. A lot of it is trying out what other people are doing and then manipulating it to fit into your own lifestyle, your day-to-day life, and what you're able to do in the Zendo and outside of the Zendo. Starting off with chapter one, we talk a little bit about Zoom etiquette. So this is kind of mainly for people who are coming in from the cloud, obviously. But this was something Domio really wanted to emphasize. When to use your camera. When should your cameras be on? Always. Again, though, as I was just highlighting, we do what we have to do. Some of us were attracted to this sangha particularly because we have the option of being anonymous at times. That's good. It's important to our mental health, to our behavioral quirks. Maybe like I'm really shy. I'm afraid of people. I have a love-hate relationship with fear. I force myself out there and then I withdraw when it comes to dealing with people. And the main reason I'm in a part of the sangha now is because I could just zoom in, not be in the presence of other people, and turn my camera off. But eventually, after some time in the breakout rooms, some time in the Saturday sangha check-ins, slowly I had these safe places where I was able to kind of like let myself out, become known to each of you, get to know you, and feel comfortable enough to do a talk in front of you and that type of thing that I'm doing right now, and to have my camera going at all times. So if you have a particular reason that's truly important to you to turn your camera off, leave it off. But otherwise, your camera should be on pretty much throughout the service. I hate this beard. My wife likes this beard. The only place that I think this beard looks worse than in the mirror is on the Zoom screen, and I want to turn it off. And I wake up with bed beard every morning, and Sundays I go for a long run, and it's always a rush to just get in the shower and clean myself up and look presentable, especially on days that I host and have to be here a half hour earlier. So it's really tempting to want to turn that camera off. But I don't think any of you are judging me. I don't even think any of you are looking at me. I think if you're anything like me, you're looking at yourself the whole time, or you're looking at Tomio when she's giving her talk. So if you're worried that your house is dirty or you have like a weird collection in the background, just blur your background and turn the camera on. If you didn't get to groom your beard that day, just look at this book and all the pictures of me and how ugly this beard is. Like, I'm the worst model. So more acknowledgements. Thanks to everybody who sent pictures in to go into this book, because if it was all me, people wouldn't want to keep turning the pages. Like, I made myself as presentable as is possible. But that's not saying much. When should your cameras be off? If something is distracting that's going on, this picture that Jinryu sent in here, where she looks great. She's sitting in a modified sort of, it looks like a combination between like a Seiza position and a Burmese position. We'll get into all the different meditation positions later in the book. If there's time, you'll at least have access to them later when you look at the book yourself. But her cat's doing just sitting there with her. She's, I don't know if it's a he or she, but the cat is not a distraction. It's doing something that could perfectly well be done on camera. That's not going to distract other people all the time trying to do Zazen. If it's like walking on your keyboard and sending out notes on the chat and like poking at the camera, maybe just take a minute to go turn off your camera and deal with the situation. But otherwise, your camera should be on unless something really unusual is happening that's going to distract people. Position your camera. There's that beard. So it can, you don't have to keep moving it in between different situations. We stand, we sit, we kneel, we bow. So if you can, like find a place in your house where you can position the camera so it sees you from all the positions. So you don't have to keep moving your camera around and moving around your room. You can focus more on the forms than how you're seen on camera. But try to stay visible throughout if that's possible. If your house doesn't allow this, do what you can do. It doesn't matter. But the more you can do, the better. Keeping the cameras on is really helpful to me, especially during Zazen. Like, I think for all of us in the cloud, especially everyone in the dirt, Zendo has to worry. Like, if they have, start having a coughing fit or start sneezing, or they get cold or they get too hot, they can't do anything about it. But if I'm here in my house with the camera off, and I get too hot, I turn on the fan. I get up and turn on the fan. But if my camera's on, I'm not going to do that, because even though I know you're not looking at me, I'm afraid I'm going to distract you. Just like when I go to the session at Shasta Abbey, I had this time where I had just a really bad cough. It was allergy season. I kept coughing, and I had to find a way to do that without coughing on people and interrupting their zazen. And those challenges are the point of zazen. The point of zazen, I think, is to be able to sit through being uncomfortable for a little while, being too hot, being too cold, and not being able to do anything about it. So when we get up and get ready for work afterwards, and the shoelace breaks on our shoes, and the battery's dead, and the electric toothbrush, and the car doesn't start, we've already dealt with dealing with adversity. We've already struggled once today, and we got through it. So we can get through all this other stuff. So by keeping the camera on, we have the same advantage that all of you in the dirt Zendo have of having to sit through adversity, of having to just be polite to the person sitting next to us and just get through it no matter what problems are happening while we're trying to sit. Microphone should be off unless it's our turn to talk. The chat feature should not be overused. This group does not do that. I've never seen that happen. We should just be doing relative stuff in the chats. I belong to another group where that's not full of a bunch of people that are trying to let go of their egos. And there'll be a person giving a talk, and people are putting like 7-paragraph long comments in the chat. And it's like, who's reading that? Like, who are you writing that for? And they just keep popping up. Like, everybody's constantly like chiming in on the talk. It's like, why are you here listening to this talk if you're gonna write 3 paragraphs, 7 paragraphs, and comments over and over again? So the chat, this isn't a problem in this group, but like, use the chat as necessary, but keep it to a minimum. When we're chanting at home, in the cloud, let's keep our microphones off. It messes with the sound. If we all have ours on, the only microphones should be on are the ones in the dirt Zendo. When we're sitting Zazen, our mics should be off. Our camera should be pointing at us. This is a great example of a good angle for your camera to take when you're sitting. How Jimmy is here. Not staring, we shouldn't be staring at the camera, but we should be on the camera. When we go to when we're invited to breakout rooms, you should try to go. Like, especially if you're one of those people who are not comfortable with being on camera. Like, that's a cool, like, safe space with a lot of friendly people who just want to get to know you. Sitting in a room with just three or four other people, and you get to know each other. You get to learn a lot. You get to come out of your shell if you're in one. There's just a lot of advantages. And it makes life easier on the host, speaking from experience. Like, when you don't know who's going to go to the breakout rooms, you make these breakout rooms where, and like, one person shows up, and then you have to shuffle them around to another room. And it's not hard to do, but you're putting that person through some stuff, like just moving them from room to room. And sometimes you'll move them to a room, but then everyone in that room will leave. Weirdly, I don't know what's going on, but the breakout rooms are fun, so I think you should go. And then during the talk in class, ask questions when appropriate. Keep your microphone off otherwise. You all know this. We have 3 minutes left and six chapters to go.
Oh, great.
Yes.
You can put you on the spot, but can you continue with this next week?
I will be out of town next week, and I will not be zooming in. I can follow up with this too in 2 weeks if that's not a
Sure.
big.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, great. I mean, maybe we'll even drag it on 3 weeks. I don't know, because people, I think, would love to also be able to discuss and ask questions and stuff. So, all right.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
it won't be the end.
Okay, yeah, I'll pick up on chapter 2 2 weeks from today.
So you can
So,
wrap it up however you like now.
all right, 3 minutes. Any questions before we all go, Brian?
Do you consider this a living document that will be changed over time? If people have any input, can they just send you like a note and maybe have some suggestions or some questions that you may want to incorporate into the write? Like, example, on top of the cameras, I found things like you have gallery view and you have speaker view, and I like to put on speaker so that only Domio comes up on the screen when she's teaching or whoever asks a question. They come up. I don't have all the little squares. I just, the more, like, these are all little hints that make it easier.
I'm not sure what your thoughts
I'm
on that.
asking whether or not people should send you questions or suggestions for any modifications to this document, a living document that we may, or you think it's pretty well
I mean, I don't
done.
want to work on it, right? But if there are helpful comments that you all think would be good to include that aren't already there, that's great. If you want to send them out on the email list, the listserv. If you have tips for that are going to help people, that's great too. I'm willing. I'll defer to Tomio for how she wants me to deal with.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Can you take us off screen share?
I'm trying to do that, and I can't figure out how. I've been trying since Brian started his question. Does anyone know how to do that? I'm kind of lost in this, like, Zoom maze right now. What happens if I do this? Is this okay? Here, I see. Are we there? Okay. Sorry about that. Where are those tech problems I mentioned? Any other questions before we get going?
I just wanted to make one comment. Really appreciate this for being somebody who is mostly in the dirt Zendo, but occasionally comes in from the cloud, because I think we have kind of a unique perspective where we're used to how it is in the dirt Zendo, and it's easy to kind of forget. Maybe we don't have the same type of established habits when we're at home. So it's really nice to have that reminders, like somebody that's in the cloud 100% of the time, you develop your habits, you develop your form, you know, you have your everything set up the way you want, and you do it the same way every time, more than likely, right? But for somebody like me, it's like, oh yeah, I need to, you know, so it's a really nice reminder for how we should interact when we enter the cloud as well. So I appreciate it very much, Greg.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, James.
And I just want to say, as far as I'm concerned, this can be a document in process. I mean, or we can, you know, develop additional resources or something. But I just really want to thank Greg and point out that y'all may not be aware, but we have 104 pledging members. Half of them are Cloud Zendo members. And I would say of the, you know, 50 some people who are local, I would say probably about 30, 35 of them also participate regularly in the cloud. So like there's very few people who only come to the Dirt Zendo. So this is relevant for, and it's relevant, like the subsequent chapters are relevant for home practice, which is where most of our time is anyway. So look forward to subsequent talks. You want to say the closing verse?
I forget. I don't have it memorized. Would you say?
All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.